Hi, I'm Lena.
And I'm Amon.
And this is Grounded Geeks,
where we make the geek world relevant.
You almost said Greek
again.
I'm just going to keep that. All right, folks. So today we're talking about, well, first of all, happy May the 4th. Is that no? May the 4th be with you. Whatever. Okay. May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you, everyone.
No one says happy May the 4th, do they? They just say
May no. The they 4th just say May the 4th be with you.
I know. I'm okay. Clearly, not a great Star Wars nerd. That's not me. But so May the 4th be with you. We're talking today about The Mandalorian and religious extremism, yeah. Which maybe people find strange because. What, why, what, how is there religious extremism in The Mandalorian? But we're going to dive into that. And yeah, so this is a special week because we're releasing this episode on a Tuesday, May the 4th. So there, everyone.
So, yeah, there you go. I mean, I don't know. When I watched The Mandalorian, I was like, this is going to be perfect for us to cover. And what a better time than May the 4th?
Yeah, exactly.
And in terms of the religious extremism, I don't know about our audience necessarily, but for me, as soon as the second season had aired, that was the first thing that popped into my mind. I was like, oh,
right.
That's what's been going on this whole time. Everything yeah. all of a sudden makes sense.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, okay. I think we should make it clear. Amon and I have approached probably all Star Wars content from very different perspectives because my knowledge of Star Wars is pretty much limited to episodes 1 through 9. I haven't seen Clone Wars or anything. Amon, you have.
I watched Star Wars Clone Wars that was run by Genndy Tartakovsky. It was a mini series way back in the day. Mm-hmm. And then George Lucas, I guess, was unsatisfied with it. And then you have the CGI animated Star Wars, The Clone Wars. I watched all of that. And then after Disney bought Lucasfilm, they canceled Clone Wars and launched Star Wars Rebels, which actually had the same people working on it as in Clone Wars.
Yeah.
And I am now super excited for The Bad Batch, which is
should be out
by the time people hear it. Here yeah. this episode.
I always misread that title, as I'm sure lots of people do. So The Bad Batch. Yeah. So yeah. So Amon basically has a lot more Star Wars knowledge than me. When I started watching The Mandalorian, I was like, cool, this is fun. And then I saw Baby Yoda and like everyone else, I fell in love. So I didn't know anything about Mandalorians or Mandalore, the history of it, all that stuff. And I went to it. Yeah. Okay. So Amon did. And I went to it thinking, oh, okay, I guess all Mandalorians are like that. They don't take off their helmets, blah, blah. I don't even remember. Sorry if this is blasphemous, but I don't remember Boba Fett from the original. He was in the original Star Wars movies, right?
Yeah. That's pretty blasphemous, Lena.
I'm so sorry.
How about you keep that to yourself?
I just don't.
I mean,
no, like I remember.
It was a very bit role. Well, actually, right. It wasn't that bit of a role. You remember that scene when Han Solo ends up in Carbonite?
Yeah. Oh, is he the one? He's the one who brought him there.
He captured him or something. Yeah, he's the one who did all of the stuff to help capture him. And then Boba Fett is the one who then took the Carbonite frozen Han Solo to Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen him. I just didn't remember much of what happened. What he did,
yeah.
Whatever.
To be fair, when the original movies came out, Boba Fett was a bit character. He was just supposed to be a random bounty hunter. But mm-hmm. then when he became so popular, George Lucas and Lucasfilms then expanded everything about Boba Fett. Not just Boba Fett as a person, but where his armor comes from, the whole culture behind it. This is an early version of the release the Snyder Cut movement, where it was just the fans being like, we want to know more about this badass bounty hunter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from there, it wasn't just, oh, let's learn a little bit more about Boba Fett. It turned into a planet.
No. Yeah.
It turned into a planet.
The whole freaking planet. Okay. Yeah. So essentially, I think actual Star Wars proper fans, nerds, knew that the way that the main character from the Mandalorian show, what's his name again? Why am I blanking on his name?
Din Djarin.
Din Djarin, yes. So I think they and you also knew, right? That like, that's not how Mandalorians are supposed to be, where he's like, this is the way, we don't take off our helmets, blah, blah, blah.
Well, at least for me, it was confusing because I wasn't sure whether this was supposed to be just a specific group of Mandalorians. I thought that maybe they were retconning things, you know, like changing it up, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Like just ignoring everything that had been done in the cartoon shows and being like, we're reestablishing Mandalorians as a culture, et cetera, et cetera.
Which would be strange for Disney to do because they're all about world building. And obviously they do a good job of it.
They left the Clone Wars series as canon, but they also decanonized a lot of stuff had already been established in the extended Star Wars universe.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we both approached it. And then season two came along, and the episode where I'm going to call him Mando because I like calling him Mando, where Mando meets Bo-Katan and her two fellow colleagues. And you know, when they basically
whose arrive, names I don't remember either.
I know. So, and in that scene, I forget the number, but I think that episode is called The Heiress because I just rewatched it. But
episode four, season two?
No, I think it's later than that. I remember it's a later number because I just rewatched it. But anyway, so, you know, they swoop in, Bo-Katan and her two colleagues, and they're wearing that Mandalorian armor and the helmets, but it's like blue, and they basically save Mando and Grogu, and you realize, oh snap, okay, there's other Mandalorians. Finally, Mando's been trying to find other Mandalorians, and then like mid-conversation they take off their helmets. I just love Pedro Pascal, is so good. Let's shout out to
he's
him.
Amazing.
Yeah, the way that he can give off any sort of emotion by just his body language or a turn of his head, because you obviously cannot see his face most of the show, is really impressive. And you can tell right away he's so freaked out that they just took off their helmets.
Freaked out. And then his instant reaction is, and this was really the moment where I was like, religious extremism, it just hit me across the face.
Me too.
His instant reaction of, you're not real Mandalorians. Yeah. You know, I mean, that cuts to the heart of any religious extremism.
Yeah.
All right. Where the people who are part of that philosophy, theology, whatever you want to call it, immediately view anybody who doesn't follow everything exactly the way they do isn't one of them.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, being Muslims, this is sort of the, I'm just going to go there with Islamic extremism. You have people who are indoctrinated into these very, very extreme versions of Islam, which are quite frankly unrecognizable to me, and I'm sure unrecognizable to you as well.
Right.
But they very much view anybody who doesn't follow things exactly the way they do as not being Muslims at all. Even though, Lena, you and I know that much like any other religion, there are people who follow different philosophical variants of Islam.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have Sunnis, you have Shias, you have Ahmadis, and even within Sunniism, which is the vast majority of Muslims in the world, there are different Islamic legal philosophies, Hanafis, Hanawis, which are all named after the prominent legal scholars who came up with these frameworks. But for most of these, you don't have people saying, oh, you follow this other thing, you're not a real Muslim. You don't have that. But that's how you can then tell that somebody is an extremist.
Yeah.
You know, when they renounce, when they just declare immediately that any variation on the belief system is not true. And not only is it not true, that you're not one of them.
Right.
That you're not one at all.
Which is just funny, right? And again, religious extremism can be found in any religion, not just Islam. Message to all the haters out there. So, I mean, you know, someone can be like, you're not a real Christian, you're not a real Jew, you whatever. And I just think it's funny because when you get to the heart of any religion. Like, I feel like any person who's truly very spiritual recognizes the fact that they don't really have a right to call anyone a real, quote unquote, real Muslim, real Christian, real Jewish person, you know? So yeah. It's just funny. Anyway, that's a side note on that. But yeah.
But that was sort of in the man, going back to The Mandalorian, that was sort of the moment where I think mm-hmm. everybody realized that what we had been seeing in the show throughout this whole time
mm-hmm.
was not the majority of Mandalorians. That yeah. this was in fact what, so that initial confusion that everybody had of like, oh, are they retconning, you know, Mandalorian culture mm-hmm. or what's going on? All of a sudden, that was the moment where everybody realized, no, we've actually this entire time been observing this small, extreme segment of Mandalorian yeah. society. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was really well done, really well played. And, yeah. you know, it was also just super nice seeing that message reinforced with the introduction of Bo-Katan. So for yeah. those of us who grew up watching, who watched all the cartoons and everything, for us, it wasn't just a moment of the writers and storytellers and showrunners saying, oh, you've just been observing a small thing. They make it very clear that everything that you knew before is actually still true.
Yeah.
Because Bo-Katan was a character who existed. And also, just a shout out to everyone at Star Wars for the awesomeness of bringing Katie Sackhoff back as Bo-Katan, because she was yeah. the voice of Bo-Katan
yeah.
in Star Wars Rebels and Clone Wars. And it was just so fantastic seeing her portray this character in real life. Picture yeah. perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was pretty awesome. I mean, I obviously haven't even seen Clone Wars, but I can appreciate how I would totally be nerding out about that if I
oh, yeah.
Been. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I nerded out hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. I also really like mm-hmm. how, I mean, I thought it was great that they did that in a way, because what they could have done was for the audience, maybe starting in season one, they could have mm-hmm. told us, oh, you know what? Mando's part of this weird cult. and yeah. not all Mandalorians are like this. They totally could have, you know, like let the audience know, but not Mando know. And then he finds out later, but
right.
you kind of go on this journey with him. And you're also kind of shocked to see you as the audience. I mean, you know, you're shocked yeah. to see, whoa, 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 whoa. There's other kinds of Mandalorians like this. They take off their helmets. Oh my God. And yeah. so it's just, it was, I thought it was just like it was a great, very small way of just showing like, hey, it's very easy to get indoctrinated, right? Because by the time, this was like halfway through season two, and
yeah,
by this time we were all like, cool, okay, Mandalorians are like this, blah blah, like we were all, you know, we were just, you know,
so drinking the Kool-Aid. So yeah, one thing that doing it this way I thought was really masterful mm-hmm. was that when you're watching the news, okay, and you hear about, you know, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the KKK, they're very much viewed in term, they're very much presented in the news media, ideology first, and then everybody else is just a no-faced player
yeah.
in it. Mm-hmm. Okay. In The Mandalorian, by telling it this way, we as the audience already grew attached to Din Djarin as a person
yeah.
before finding out that he's actually part of a death cult.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, and so in this particular case, and I think it's a lesson to be taken for the broader world, is that there are real people involved in these cults. They mm-hmm. are all humans, crazy and psychotic they might be, and yeah. robotically indoctrinated as they might be, they're still humans, and yeah. they are all probably going through some kind of an individual journey of yeah. their own, something that either brought them to where they are or a journey to help them out of where they are.
Right.
And
this is,
that was just really well done. And, yeah. and something really important to do, whether the showrunners realized it or not.
Yeah. And this isn't to say to like justify the actions of, you know, people like ISIS or the KKK, you know,
no, when no,
we,
not at
when
all.
We draw parallels like this, but you're right. It is important to remember that there are it's made up of individual actual human beings, these, you know, these sort of cults. And
right,
and that's the only way to, I think, to fight off religious extremism. Otherwise, you just end up breeding more religious extremists by the way yeah. that we've been, you know, doing our war on terror. You know, it's been going real well these past 20 years. But yeah, it's
yeah,
important
I mean,
to keep in mind.
I mean, the most successful efforts that I've read about of people successfully turning those who are part of these extremist ideologies away from these extremist ideologies have all involved stories where each of these people are treated as an individual and they're treated as human and they are approached in that way. So I remember this one story about this woman who goes around these different towns in, I can't remember if it's in Afghanistan or in Pakistan, but she basically goes to the homes of people who she knows are part of these extremist groups. I think in this case, this was like a long time ago that I read this story, maybe like 10, 15 years ago, even at this point. She didn't talk to them. Right? She talked to mostly their mothers and basically approached them as a missionary. And so this one particular story, you know, she went to this person's home, to this woman, and said, "Hey, what do you know about the Quran? You know, I'm a Quranic teacher." She doesn't talk to the guy who is the extremist. She talks to his mother. All right. And goes there every day, every week, or whatever the case is, and basically goes through the Quran with this woman and points out all of the different things and really teaches her the lessons in the Quran from a scholarly perspective and with the evidence right in front of her, i.e. a copy of the Quran right in front of her. And the thing is that the woman who is doing this doesn't know what sort of conversations the mom is having with her son. All right. But after a while, the son starts to show up. He doesn't say anything to this woman. All right. He just sits there. Observing and listening to the conversation, the lessons that are happening. And eventually he realizes that what he's been following is not actually a true version of what is taught in the Quran. But the thing that's masterful about this story is that nobody addressed him directly. He was approached in the appropriate cultural context. And it was like he was approached as an individual who exists in a specific culture, in a specific place. And it wasn't like trying to, you know, give big speeches and just speak to everybody outside of the context of their individual lives, their in the individual circumstances that they're in. You know, they were all approached. He was approached as an individual through the appropriate cultural channels, but the appropriate cultural channels for him, you know,
what
worked with him may not have worked in some other part of the world. And that's something important to keep in mind. And that's why that was so impactful for me in The Mandalorian, was that we became attached to the main character as an individual. Before we found out that he was actually part of this extremist insane group.
And you realize that how isolated Mando's life has pretty much been, you know, since he was a kid. You know, his parents died, right? And then he was basically brought in to this
Mandalorian adopted, basically.
He was adopted and stuff. But it's been very isolating. They've literally been this underground cult. And he was not exposed to anything else. And that's what happens in, quite frankly, the real world as well, you know? And
The parallels here are uncanny. This was not, you can just tell that this was, this show, this was not developed in a vacuum.
You know,
a lot of parallels to how things really happen in the real world.
And the thing is, these people who, which I hate this term so much, where, you know, the people who become radicalized, it's as if it's like, I don't know why radicalized makes me think like, I don't know, like you've got some sort of, it just sounds weird, like a light switch going on in someone's head or something. And I don't know how to describe it, but it just sounds stupid. It just oversimplifies it that, oh, well, he became radicalized. That's why he's a terrorist now. Like, okay, dude.
As opposed to the probably very long and journey that specific individual probably went through, which is probably unique to that individual in most cases.
And we know that in so many cases, people become quote unquote radicalized because they're poor, you know, they're trying to eat, they're trying to provide food for their families. They're trying to,
in many cases it's that, in many cases it's not, you know, I mean, there's true. A lot of,
I'm, that's one example in, I'm saying.
Yeah. It's one example. Another example, quite frankly, is just, you know, people who are well off, middle class in the US and the UK, who just don't see their struggles being acknowledged by the broader society, and thinking that there is something wrong with the world and going to radicalization in that way, which I mean, I'm not saying that to counterpoint what you're saying, Lena,
right?
More to just emphasize that all these people truly are individuals. It can happen in any way because these are real people that we're talking about.
Right. And it's also, I mean, and this doesn't just happen in third world countries. Every time there's a mass shooting in the US, guess what? That's someone who's been, for lack of a better term, radicalized. You know, it's just, I mean, that's another thing, right? I mean,
it's another version.
Like you said, they feel isolated. They feel like they're not recognized or valued. And in some
or
way,
any combination of those things.
Yeah, yeah. Or they've been fed some sort of hate-filled ideology against a group of people. And yeah, so it's just, I don't know. It's pretty, anyway, but the point I was trying to say is that it's like we see in The Mandalorian, all of a sudden we start recognizing like, wow, this Mando really grew up very, very isolated and not exposed to a lot of things. Like, yes, he goes around, he's a bounty hunter, travels, all this stuff, but that's very different from having actual connection and exchanges with other people.
Yes. So I thought it was interesting moving on to the next phase, you know, after realizing that this guy, that Din Djarin, is part of a extremist cult of Mandalorians, his progression to loosening up after that. It was after his encounter with Bo-Katan that you start to see him bend the rules slightly. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
There's this one scene in the episode after where he and Grogu are sitting on the ship eating, and Din Djarin is lifting his helmet up just enough to take a sip from his cup. And, you know, I'm doing this pantomime for the audience because, you know, podcast is such a visual platform. They can see me cupping my hands and lifting this imaginary helmet.
He's doing a great job, everyone. He's doing great.
It's enough where he's doing that, but not enough for Grogu to really see his face.
Yeah.
But the thing is that that's the first time he does that. In a season and a half, that is the first time he even lifts up his helmet enough in front of anybody else to even take a sip from a cup.
Right.
And that includes Grogu.
Otherwise, he just wouldn't eat or drink anything.
But yeah. In the first season, when they're doing that whole, you know, Seven Samurai episode, where they're saving this farming village where he first meets Cara Dune. He takes his meals alone in a hut by himself with the windows closed, with the doors closed and everything, you know, because he doesn't want anybody to see even a little bit of his face. But after his meeting with Bo-Katan and I guess a realization that his way of this is the way is not the only quote unquote way.
Right.
And starting to loosen up a little bit after this, I think that having that exposure, as well as this deepening emotional attachment to Grogu, start to move him away from his more hardcore concrete beliefs. Like when they're breaking in episode 7 of season 2, I think, where they're trying to steal the coordinates of where Moff Gideon's ship is, and he's got to take off his helmet for the...
Oh yeah, it's later. It's later than 7, I think. But go on.
There's only 8 episodes.
I know, but they number it differently. Oh, sorry. I keep forgetting because they start season two. The first episode is called episode 9.
So I know, that's, but that's why I'm
getting thrown off. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm saying season 2, episode 7.
No, I know. But
so,
whatever. Okay.
So, yeah, like in that episode, first, he replaces his Mandalorian helmet with the Stormtrooper helmet or whatever, or transport crew helmet. Whatever. Anyways, they're driving along, and Bill Burr's character, Mayfeld, is just like really laying it out to him, like, hey, you know, we all got rules. Until shit hits the fan. Mm-hmm. And then those rules, you know, everybody's got, what is that line that he says? Everybody's got a line they won't cross until they do.
Yeah.
And you start to see the cracks in the ideology and how far Din Djarin is willing to go for Grogu. And especially now that he knows that maybe you can still be a Mandalorian without adhering to this extreme cultish ideology.
Yeah,
you know, he takes off his helmet, and yeah,
I think he essentially starts very slowly making decisions for himself, and realizing he can do that rather than because at that point he just it was almost being led by fear, right? Fear of the rules. Yeah. What's going to happen? I'm going to be thrown out from my Mandalorian family. If I don't follow these rules and all this stuff. And
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, that's a good point.
And you just see him starting to make decisions for himself, starting to figure out for himself, okay, what are things that I value? What are things that I'm willing to, you know, go as far as I need to go for all this stuff. And he realizes he cares about Grogu. Who wouldn't?
Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
So that's the biggest thing that he starts formulating, I think, his own values and his own value system.
I think that's the right way to put it. His own values, his own person of what are things that are important to him as compared to other things. And I think it's going to be interesting to see where season 3 goes because he's now the ruler. If he's now basically the de facto ruler of Mandalore.
Oh yeah, right. That's true.
You know, I mean, that's gonna change a lot of things. Yeah. He then now has a choice basically if he's gonna start this journey of trying to unite all Mandalorians.
Yeah, you
know, that's true. Is he going to try to take all of Mandalore towards the Death Watch? Is his primary advisor going to be the armor? Armorer. You know, Emily Swallow's character,
who's right.
Or is he going to try to shift Death Watch towards more mainstream Mandalorian culture?
Yeah.
You know, or is it going to be something else in between? Like, he now has the power to make choices that can affect all of Mandalorian culture.
Right.
All right. And it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. And I think, like everybody, want to see baby Grogu come back and have a Mandalorian helmet with giant ears on it. You know, I want that. I don't know about you, but I want that.
That would be so cute. But his face is so cute. I don't want it covered.
I know, but I want him to like be like, I want to be just like daddy and have a Mandalorian helmet with the big ears to accommodate his big ears. I just think that would be more adorable.
I wonder how his Jedi training is going to go. Poor little
I'm going to guess not so well.
Why?
Well, because we didn't hear about him in episode 7, 8, or 9.
Hear about who?
Huh? About Grogu.
What do you mean? We see him at the end.
Luke Skywalker. I meant the movies.
Oh, the movies. 7, 8, 9. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. Well, I was like, he's in the show. What are you talking about?
Since we don't hear about him, something's going to happen and he does not become the Jedi Master that Yoda was.
Stop. Okay. Maybe he does, but he's like very on the DL and doesn't like a lot of publicity. Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying, I think that there's honestly, a whole other thing about Jedi culture being kind of an extremist cult of its own.
Honestly, I kind of just want to forget about episode 9 altogether. It was such a disappointing movie. I hated it.
Yeah.
It was awful.
It was. And and I've thought about this, that like, now this is what makes The Mandalorian great and makes episode 9 not so great is that the people working on The Mandalorian really know Star Wars, not just know it. They like really know it at like a, not just knowledge, but understanding it at a deep fundamental level.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is that that is what then allows you to build out the world.
Yeah.
You know, episode 9 had no world building in it. They didn't build out any cultures. They didn't extend what was there.
Well, honestly, even outside of really knowing Star Wars lore and all that, just trying to come up with plots in a movie, like you, the movie episode 8 was going in one direction and episode 9 just completely ignored everything that was happening. Yeah. Like at least when it comes to the characters, I was like, what was the point of even introducing Kelly Marie Tran's character in episode 8? If you weren't going to do anything. It was just, whatever. Anyway.
Yeah.
Point is, watch The Mandalorian. Don't watch episode 9.
Yeah. It's so much better that way.
Yeah.
Life is better that way.
Yeah. Anywho.
All right. I think I've pretty much covered just about everything. If I can find where I heard that story about that one woman who was trying to address extremism on a one-to-one basis, I'll try to find it. We'll put in the show notes, but I honest to goodness don't remember where I saw that article. It was just so long ago. Mm-hmm. But I will do my best to try to find it to share it with everyone.
Sounds good. And we are looking forward to season 3 of The Mandalorian, where we're going to see Mando at a crossroads and see what he does.
At a whole new kind of crossroads.
Mm-hmm. It should be fun.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in.
Yep. And may the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you. Bye.
Bye.